turn off our phones and refrain from texting during the meeting? Thank you.
Thank you very much, and welcome this morning to the United Lodge of Theosophy in Philadelphia. As is our custom, to welcome newcomers and to repeat always to those who have come year after year, such as the volunteers you see on the platform this morning, we just volunteer to take part in the program here. And right away, we get an idea of what is meant by independent devotion. And independent devotion is founded on the declaration of the United Lodges of Philadelphia and all over the world. And you will find a copy plus other information on this little yellow pamphlet as you come into the room at the book table or on the radiator as you go out. We ask your indulgence while we just go over a few ideas that you will find in this declaration. And we call it the policy of this lodge, is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. And no one here professes attachment, because there are no offices, no bylaws, or anything like it. And the unique thing about that is that everybody is invited to participate if they find that they are in accord with the ideas given out here. And that's a description of the two people you see on the platform this morning, and volunteer to give you the highlights of the declaration. Now, it is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but we don't get into arguments or dissensions or disagreements about what is given out in these teachings. It keeps in front of us the very absorbing and lofty ideas that you will find given out from the platform in this forum, where we study, we present a particular part of the program, and then we throw the whole place open for questions and answers. That means if this is your first visit, you are also invited to participate in the program. Therefore, it holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever they are, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. And the state doesn't have any constitution or bylaws. And if this is your first visit, we regard as theosophists anyone who is engaged in the true service of humanity, and race and sex and creed and those things don't mean anything. As you see, the doors were open this morning at 10:30, and we began promptly at 11, and it'll be over by noontime. That's on Sunday morning. And usually the program is listed in the window as you come in, and you'll find there the topic that will be taken up this morning. In addition, our other meeting is on Wednesdays, and that's from 7:45 until 9:00. And you can get in the door at 5:30 and go into the library if you wish and examine our reference library. And there you will find another volunteer, just like us, who will help you familiarize yourself with the literature that's available to study, to take home with you. You go to the book table, and you will find the same literature there in the form of pamphlets, magazines, and booklets. And the explanation given in these booklets, a child would be able to understand it perfectly. So therefore, it's not what you call Yale University or Harvard or anything like that. Everyone is welcome. And I'd like to say, in these rooms, visitors would be a Yale graduate or someone who barely finished grammar school, the equality and the nature of our effort here illustrate what is on the declaration. And that one sentence we would like to read. To spread the broadcast, the teachings of theosophy as so recorded by the founders and also by those students who are no longer with us, who provided these rooms through voluntary contributions of time, work, and money. Now, this morning, being the 10th of November, there's a scheduling here for 3 months, all the way from October to December. Today is the 10th, the topic, Karma, the Law of Justice and Mercy. Now, on Wednesdays, we have an open discussion where we synthesize chapters or parts of chapters from that famous little book called The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. There you have volunteers who come up, synthesize the part, the big word, put it together, and then open for questions and answers afterwards. Now, we stated that this morning the topic will be karma, the law of justice and mercy. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. So we're going to invite a volunteer and fellow student to give a talk on karma, the law and justice of justice and mercy. And we'd like to bring to mind here that if one peruses the ancient teachings, we find certain statements in those teachings such as, karma is the cornerstone of esoteric philosophy, that karma is the ultimate power of the universe. So when we think of karma, sometimes we think of the word and its definition, which I'm sure will be addressed. But let's also think of karma as a spiritual doctrine. And we'll learn a bit about that spiritual doctrine this morning.
If we dismiss the childlike belief of a personal God who, in contradiction to observable universal law, promises to absolve us of all responsibilities for our actions, and instead think and ask intelligent questions such as, how is it that I am born at this time, under such conditions, in this place, and among these people, and not at some previous time or future time when the world might be better? Or how did the world get into such a state? And of course, the old standby, why am I here? For what aim and purpose? If we ask these questions with sincerity, and prepare ourselves for the challenge of answers that are contrary to everything that we've probably been told all our lives, we can begin a rewarding, life-changing search and study. The idea of karma offered by theosophy gives a clear understanding of who we are, why we're here, and why it is the seat of justice and mercy for humanity. The first thing that we need to understand is that karma is a unique juncture where man's future, present, and past, moral, physical, mental, and spiritual well-being coincide. Simply stated, karma is the law of action and reaction. And it's through this process and under this law that man learns and grows into his full potential. This law isn't something separate or outside of ourselves, but exists at the very core of our being. It is the law of man's own action. As we act, affecting others positively or negatively, we receive the reaction from those positive or negative effects, which we cause others to experience. Armed with this knowledge, we can see justice in karma because it allows us to make choices that are in accord with law in the light of karma and not in the darkness of ignorance. It makes us aware and accepting of our lawful responsibilities. Our choices are not hapstance or accidental, but deliberate and meaningful, and the power of knowledge can be drawn from them. This knowledge also brings us to another phase of our being. Now we see something that is ongoing in its operation, residing in us, something that is continuous from life to life. From this new vantage point, our view changes. We begin to think in terms of ages rather than the short span of one life. A new vision of reality comes to us. We open the door so that those internal, real, more permanent perceptions can find operation in our daily waking thoughts. We have now been embraced by mercy in the form of hope. It is no longer one life, heaven or hell, but an ongoing becoming, a being realized from many points of view. Each of us has the power to take the course which to him seems best. And in taking the course, he sows and must also reap, as was the nature of his sowing. Every being in this universe of law is experienced as he is because of his own thoughts, words, and deeds. Every circumstance, every misshapen day, every good and evil that comes to us is due to thoughts, words, and deeds from our past. In each incarnation, we are surrounded by friends as well as enemies. Each one of us represents both the highest divine nature and also the very lowest, the infernal nature. His decisions must be made with this in mind. He must feed his higher nature with the best decisions he is capable of making. Understanding his past, justifying his present, and building his future. Sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. Justice and mercy.
Yes.
In your introduction, you mentioned the spiritual doctrine. What's the difference between holding a spiritual doctrine and holding a dogma?
We love that question. So let's get started with that. What's the difference between a dogma and a spiritual doctrine? Well, a dogma is an idea or a teaching, and a spiritual doctrine is an idea or a teaching. The difference is, what is the source of the power of the dogma, and what is the source of the power of the spiritual idea? The source of the power of the spiritual idea is inherent in the idea itself. And because it is, when someone in this lifetime hears a particular spiritual idea for the first time, it will take root as a seed. And depending on the conditions of the individual's mind and heart, that seed will grow roots and blossom in certain ways given outer conditions and beliefs and how the individual thinks, but it will grow of its own power. Similar to how the embryo is not fed by the mother. Rather, the embryo takes from the mother everything that it needs to grow within her. It's the power of the embryo that becomes the fetus and becomes the human being. Well, what's the difference between that and a dogma? A dogma is also an idea or a teaching, but a dogma is a teaching which in certain ways is true, and because in certain ways, under certain conditions, it can be true. Because it can be true, there's something in the dogma that is magnetizing. And so it will magnetize individuals because they'll see a kernel of truth in the teaching and then accept that, well, then this must be a true teaching. But really, what is the power of the dogma? The power of the dogma is a function of how many minds can I get believing this idea. The more minds that believe it, the more power it has, the false idea. The fewer minds that believe it, the weaker it is. So we're told that when we hear a true spiritual idea for the first time in our life, such as karma, that opens something within us that often results in the individual seeking whether or not it's true, whether he seeks it in a book or from a teacher or just it's kind of playing in the background to see, am I really responsible for everything that happens to me and that I do in this life? So maybe this is something that we'll investigate this morning. Yes, in the pink.
I'd like to add another comment to what the dogma is. It is usually something that's imposed from outside.
Thank you. So also a dogma is imposed from outside, and so the power of it has to come from outside. Thank you. Orange?
So when the spiritual doctrine is available, it's still up to soul working through a personality and a body to check it to make sure that this isn't dogma, that this is a spiritual, eternal truth. There's a freedom of almost like a scientific method involved in one as opposed to passivity involved in the other.
Well, if we stand back from what everybody else's opinion is about any given spiritual or religious idea, and make our own personal decision to investigate it. If it's true, if the idea is true, there's going to be a way by either analogy or experience or finding correspondences in all world religions or throughout all civilizations, and it'll start with striking a chord within us, kind of like, this must be true, but I'm not sure yet. And then we either prove it to ourselves or not. Well, if it is a true idea, all thinking men and women can prove it to themselves. That's not the case with the dogma. Yes?
Well, to simplify matters, in the reading from the Declaration, we could see that our participation, there are no strings attached. And that the word independent devotion teaches man to know for himself. We're no longer Pinocchio. And that's a good illustration of why many of us come to listen, because outside we got strings attached, and those strings can hurt and cause damage and disagreement and so forth. First word we hear when we enter here is independent devotion. No strings attached.
Thank you for the contribution. Yes, and stripes.
And we think, too, with doctrines, as was said, it's almost like a doctrine can, especially with theosophy, will invite, you know, someone to check and test and verify, whereas with a dogma, you know, it is what it is.
Thank you. So to combine those two last contributions here, with dogmas that are promulgated, somebody out there has an interest, a personal interest, in you believing this. That's one of the bases of a dogma. That's a surefire sign. However, in theosophy, really, we take a very impersonal approach to it. We personally practice in our lives if we so choose to, but we don't impose it on anyone else because theosophy, so to speak, is not for everyone until they've decided for themselves. And so there are no strings attached. This building will continue to operate if it offers value to the community and the community feels that it's worth volunteering and contributing to. But there are no strings attached. So we don't have a membership. We don't require, you know, annual payments or whatever. So the question is, these true theosophical ideas, or rather the ideas that theosophy presents to us, are they true or are they not? And whether or not they are, that's going to determine whether or not theosophy continues in this world. And there's no strings attached to it. Yes, in the pink?
It's very funny that we keep saying no strings attached because karma couldn't mean more strings attached.
Right.
Everything you think and say and feel and do has a result and an effect for you. It was said
it's
in
true.
The talk that the karma for the way we make someone else feel. Well, some people are very touchy and some people misunderstand you. So how does our responsibility for how we make others feel actually work? Because it can't be how they feel. It has to have something to do with my action.
So what responsibility do we have when it comes to how we make others feel? Well, it really depends on the motive and what our desire is. So, for instance, we'll find that The basis for karma is in desire, okay? The basis for karma is in desire. But the basis of desire, you know, karma is an action, and the basis for the action is in the mind. So really, the real cause is in the mind. Sometimes we think, I put my hand in the fire, that's a cause, the effect is I got burned. The real cause is the idea, I'm going to put my hand in the fire. The effect is I put it in the fire, and then an effect from that, and there's all these effects, and I end up in the hospital and all that. So the question is our relationship to the effect. Because karma, you know, we talk about, well, karma is cause and effect. So karma, you know, there's always a relationship between the cause and effect within an action. But we sometimes forget that there's also a relationship between the effect and the individual who's being affected. So it's cause and effect have a relationship, and there's a relationship between the person who's being affected and the effect. So what does that mean? Well, it has directly to do with how attached are we to the effects that we put in motion. So In a perfect, most pure environment, everything that we would do, ideally, says the Bhagavad Gita, we do it simply because it's the right thing to be done without concern of what's in it for me. And if I'm able to do that, every time we do that, it goes out into the universe, and because we're not interested, we're not putting personal interest into it, then the plane upon which it manifests cannot be our own personal, emotional, physical plane. because we're not involving it with us, so we're not magnetizing it back. On the other hand, if I'm doing this because I want something out of it, then the effects are going to come back and we're going to learn from those effects. It's not a bad thing. It's the way the world works. We're going to learn from those effects either, yes, it's exactly what I expected it to be, or no, that's an opportunity for me to make certain adjustments. I mean, we can't grow in wisdom unless we observe the effects of our causes. Yes.
And there's places in the philosophy where we're warned about being a karmic agent. So as soul, if we move through life like a bull in a china shop, completely centered on, I'm okay, I'm right, my motive was pure, too bad for you if you got hurt, therein lies a flaw in the premise of the thinking. In the cause, isn't there?
Certainly. See, that's half of it. You know, my motive was pure, and if that affects you in a negative way, that's your problem because... But motive is for naught if we're not thinking right. And theosophy gives us a basis for right thinking. And step one in right thinking is, you know, not me versus it, not even me versus you. It's I, thou, together, we're one. And so there, so we both, in certain ways, are going to experience the effect of that. And we have to maintain right thinking and right motive, and we'll see perhaps right effects after that. Yes, in the green?
So I've been trying to find like more scientific explanations of how karma works. And in psychology, there's something called affective mindset, that the way you see the world shapes you, affects your life, and it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy in the sense that all human beings are subject to confirmatory bias. If there's a way in which we feel as things should happen, we have a tendency to look for evidence that validates our opinions, and we ignore any evidence that may contradict our opinions. And so in the sense that someone brings data that challenges the way we see the world, we may actually experience what they call the backfire effect, meaning that we will become more tenaciously attached to our opinions and dismiss the evidence as being wrong. And so, I mean, it's interesting when people talk about doctrine versus dogma, because I think human beings have a tendency to take ideas, and if we like those ideas, become attached to them and then impose them on other people. So you can actually dogmatize any doctrine by thinking it has to be right. There's no way it can be wrong, and force it upon people. And then in your life, create ways in which this doctrine seems true. So you become so attached to it that you dogmatize it, and then you can't accept that it could be wrong.
Everywhere. Certainly, that happens everywhere. And one example, perhaps, in the Hindu religion or the sects, you know, there are so many different sects, we think of it as one religion, but there's one group or one sect that believes that the result of karma can be that in the next life, you're going to come back as a grasshopper. Now, there's a certain, I mean, if we look at karma as cause and effect and inherently recognize, you know, it plays out, that spiritual doctrine can be seized upon by individuals with impure motives, and they can force, so to speak, upon either the passive-minded or the lazy-minded or the people who are not investigating. They can, you know, they can use that and force, you know, a twist to it that results in, yes, it's a dogma. There's a certain spiritual truth to it, but what's in it for me? And with respect to priests and priestcraft and Brahmins and things, well, we gain power as a Brahmin if I have a bigger, you know, a bigger temple. So that's what, so they'll use, you know, all priestcrafts do that. Really, it could be said, perhaps, that the only you know, if you want to fight that, you've got to take the time and study the principles of universal philosophy, or sometimes it's called esoteric philosophy, and independently decide whether or not these ideas that we're being presented with are true, regardless of how much data people are going to show us to the contrary. Yes?
The wonderful thing about the unity experienced in these rooms, we go back to the story of the founding of the United States of America in 1776. And you read that declaration, in school and so forth, and you come here and you hear the declaration here. And we often say, something familiar. Harmony, unity, and the thing that really impressed us, we looked on the back of a dollar bill and it says there, a new order of the ages. And we began to put these ideas we hear here together with whatever we bring in with us, and we find that our religions, our family codes, our civic laws and duties have been based on the law of harmony and justice and mercy. It's what we do with it that prevents it from blossoming and so forth. So
thank
here
you.
We give out those ideas to take, understand our own life out.
Thank you. So the contribution here is the forefathers put in place in the United States a foundation of laws, and we're a country of laws, and if we work within the law, then we lead as free a life as we can, which was, and they were a pretty philosophical group at the time. Some of the highest minds of the time were the four founders of the United States. And they were getting away from what? The dictum of the king. The dictum of the king in politics is congruous to the dictum of God in spiritual life. You know, is there an outside God telling me what to do based on his personal opinion on what he wants? And should another man as king tell me what to do? So the founders, given that primarily they were deists, philosophical deists, really, which means everything works under law, they established a country grounded in law as opposed to, so the power is in the law as opposed to the king, and that corresponds exactly to karma. Karma is the law of cause and effects, and it, the dictums of karma are really a function of what we do and how we think and how we feel. There's no God dictating, well, this is where you're going to be born. We're born into situations based on our previous lives. Of course, we always have to remember that the doctrine of karma and reincarnation are so intertwined that we can only fully explain one in context of the other. Yes, in the white?
It's interesting that for the period of time it took to write those documents and meet and get ideas from everyone, and that whole process of setting up the documents that we live by and have our laws by, at the same time, these people were slaveholders. So it's absolutely stunning to our mind that for the time that it took to create the dictums of how this country should run, they would go home and still have slaves on the plantation. It's amazing. Eventually, of course, the impetus was put into motion, and that ended, thank God. But never ceases to amaze.
That, and that's a perfect example of you know, there's no strings attached. Keep it impersonal. If we judge the foundation of the United States of America by the personal actions of the individual men and what they did when they went home, I mean, that's a waste. It's a waste of breath. Because really, think about it. The judgment is mine, saith the Lord, or we can read it theosophically, judgment is mine, saith the law. Who are we to judge those founders in their personal lives? Are we so spiritually developed that we can look into the past and recognize who they are and what they did and determine for ourselves that their personal lives were worth condemning? We've got a lot more work to do within ourselves. Yes.
To go along with that, it's interesting that we know in the philosophy, we're not sure where it's told that we shouldn't sue somebody because that person is going to get their, you know, the payment under karma, under law, and that if we get involved with them, it's almost as if we are interfering and it could backfire on us. But we just thought that it's an interesting thing in the philosophy.
It's an interesting idea. The philosophy says, ideally, if we do sue someone for offending us, then we're just perpetuating our own karma. Ideally, you would say, okay, well, I've been offended. Things will be taken care of. What goes around comes around. But the bigger question is, you know, how am I living my life? What have I done in the past? Why is this on my plate today? And fix, you know, this in here rather than using an outside force. We understand the contribution, yes.
The world that we live in, there's a whole gamut of possibilities. And we see people that we would consider dirty and separate, and we don't want to associate with them. They panhandle. But don't we have to admit that the lowest of society, as well as the highest society, is all part of us? That we are not separate from any of that. We're not better than any of that. That is a part of us. And how do we deal with that when it comes to our door? So, I mean, that's karma. So this whole world is our karma.
Well, certainly here at the ULT, the purpose of the ULT is to hold out the teachings of theosophy for the public, and to hold public meetings talking about the principles of theosophy. And this will result, we are told, if we promulgate the philosophy and put it in practice in our lives, it will result in a greater conviction of universal brotherhood. We'll recognize more and more that, you know, universal brotherhood, meaning we're all one. So sometimes there are those... Here's a perfect example of the abuse of a spiritual doctrine, which kind of dogmatizes it. Well, that person's got his problems, that's his karma, and I don't have time, even though he's on the cement bleeding, and I could at least make a phone call to help him. Coldly, there are those who would think, well, maybe that's his karma, do I have a duty? And the answer is, certainly you have a, I mean, yes, it's his karma, but it's also your karma that you're standing in front of a person who's in pain. So accept it. Or one, be of service. Was there in the orange?
Yeah, on the nature of the lawsuits, it is still up to each individual person that hears about that statement to stop and consider, if I've been totally incapacitated by someone else's action and I am the primary bread earner for a family, then by motive I may empathize with the poor soul who caused the accident, but I have a duty to feed these other folks. So, you know, there's a perfect example of the way that we're invited in these rooms to share ideas and to then take them to heart and consider them. Exactly how do you help another help themselves? And may you be in a situation where there's a mixed karma and we're hoping for justice and mercy, but we may not really clearly see just what that is in that moment.
Thank you. And maybe to take that just a next step. I mean, we can't kid ourselves. It's not like we're ready yet to live in a society without external laws. You know, once we are all a brotherhood of fully evolved Mahatmas, we won't need police, right? But sometimes the question arises, well, if karma is cause and effect and what goes around comes around, then what about the murderer? Capital punishment makes sense. And the answer really is, once again, that's the perfect example. Hold off. Justice is mine, judgment is mine, saith the law. And yet that's not to say in a society that it would not be appropriate to sequester that person so he cannot continue his behaviors. Go ahead.
Well, that's what life is our reaction to karma, the things that come to us. And so what's being said is that how you react to what comes to you determines your future.
Right. So what we're saying here, yes, exactly. How we react to what comes to us determines our future. But how we react is, you know, are we going to react or are we going to be proactive in our reactions? So, does that make sense? So if when it comes to me, I accept it on the basis of, I mean, one can put oneself in the habit of just being the third person observer. Here it comes again. When am I going to learn from this situation? And maybe we're fortunate enough in life to see over the years, you know what, I did this, and with those people, this is how it worked out. You know, maybe it's like, you know, I had this kind of an attitude toward this situation, and it always does the same thing. So, well, maybe I'll change my attitude in that kind of a situation, and bing, you're initiated into a new level of consciousness, you know? So yes, it's all about how we react to what's happening to us. And am I mindfully, thoughtfully, confidently deciding what my reaction is going to be? Or am I the puppy dog who's going after the toy? You know? And yes, in the pink.
Here's an additional angle, or maybe an additional look at the whole karma, law of karma. And that is, it has been stated that if you picture the universe as a network, you can think of a net, and if you pull a little bit on one, where are the effects? Could be all over the network. So whatever my action is, it could affect just one or many. And when I receive an injury or something, who knows where it comes from? So when I'm faced with a situation that maybe I don't like, or that's hurts or whatever. What's the sense of trying to figure out how did I earn this? What we really need to do is say, okay, I've been presented with this. This is my karma. So I'm going to have to go forward. And you use the word proactive.
Thank you. Thank you for
Go forward. Don't look back and think, what have you done?
Thank you. So the contribution here is, regardless of what happens, if we can go forward and do the right thing anyway without respect of what's in it for me, and if we can live our lives without looking back with remorse and the if only, oh poor me because this happened to me, but instead maintain a center balance in what's going on here and now and act mindfully and thoughtfully, then will our lives take a turn in a different direction than other ways of thinking. Now, the contribution also included, it is simply implied, the theosophical teaching that, you know, we are not this body, we are not this physical environment. But we are infinitely connected on seven planes of being in seven ways. Everything we do affects everything else around us. And so when we think with that universal brotherhood idea in mind, always rolling in the back of our mind, then when we think and act, are we probably going to have different effects in our lives than if we're more focused on the I, me, my, or just my family, or just my neighborhood, or just my tribe. So, yes, so the implication that we're all interconnected and we all affect each other for ill and good is the teaching. Yes.
And so if part of our process is to recognize that the brain works in a particular way and the body reacts to the brain in a particular way, we as mind beings are focused on justice and mercy, what would I do in terms of the golden rule or the Kuan Yin pledge in terms of mercy? That's a very different thought process in the moment from, gee, if I sue, in the future, that's going to come back to haunt me karmically.
Thank you. So then in the sense of justice, could we put the phone down? Okay, it's just a little distracting. Thank you. So then in the sense of justice and mercy, and we see the action, whether it's affecting someone else and hurting them or affecting us, step one is judge not that ye be judged. Well, why? You know, when we judge, it's as though we're determining that the moral code of that individual is wrong and ours is right. And whereas his personal moral code may be different from mine, really, perhaps I need to work more on finding out, you know, what adjustments I need to make to live my life more in a universal moral code. Now, what we mean by that is each one of us internally, within our hearts, we all have the same moral code, just considered a unit of measure, like a ruler, and it's all the same. An inch is an inch in this moral code, no matter what family, no matter what culture you're from. But yet, there are, in the external world, there are differences in what is right, what is wrong, what is moral, what's not moral. Well, if we start judging other people, then we're just going to bring the effects onto ourselves from that. When we see moral codes that are different from ours, let's get to that. Really, we could say, how can they do something differently than them and think that it's moral and they think it's moral? The way it works is, yeah, we have the same unit of measure, but the way that we see, the way that we perceive that unit, some people see that unit and they see this. Other people perceive that same unit and they see this. And that's because the mirror of our mind may not be perfectly straight. It may be convex, or it may be concave. And so we see the same thing in such a different way that we are better off making the effort to straighten out our mirror or to develop and refine and perfect our faculties so that we're less likely to judge, but rather it would seem that a person who has developed his faculties so he can more perfectly see the true measure, when he sees the difference in another person, he's not going to be judgmental about it. He will have been developed to a point where he or she will know what to say or how to help. Ultimately, all that really matters is your response to this individual something along the line that's going to help them see that they're a part of that universal network, that full human family, and leave it to them. Help them see a little bit more of what universal brotherhood is all about and that they are a part of it, and let them off for themselves. Yes, in the green.
So several hundred years ago, a great Tibetan master gave a teaching on this topic. It's called the 8 Verses of Training the Mind, and I'm just going to share a little bit of it. It begins by thinking of all sentient beings.
Actually, right, we're going to keep it to discussion back and forth within the room.
Got it. Well, the key is that you continue to see other people as souls, as beings, and you respect them and you cherish them for that. And then whenever they make a mistake or they suffer or they fail, you wish them well. You don't have to physically take on their pain and suffering, but you can send them the energies of wishing them well and hope for them to improve and to continue to evolve. I mean, that's the key point.
Yeah. Thank you. Perfect. Yes.
Well, when we consider it, it's one of the most beautiful ideas that we've ever heard of. And as you mentioned earlier, the word justice and mercy, that's a unity. And each one of us present can do their own research and say, what is it that I already am aware of that shows me the beauty in the law? Often, we give it a negative approach because we don't like to feel the effects of our mistake. But where does the effect occur? In your mind or in the body, in the form, in your surroundings? Who's in charge? The karmic effect or you?
Thank you. So, well, where does the effect occur? Karma can be physical, it can be mental, it can be psychic. It all depends on where the effect started, or rather where the cause started, you know, the effect comes back to. And the implication here in the contribution is primarily is who's in charge, the karma or who I am, and how I react to that karma. Thank you. How I choose to react to that karma. Yes, Green.
Could some of the chronic diseases that are so common nowadays be the result of, is that a release of karma through the physical plane? We're wondering, what might be the source?
So the question here has to do with, you know, the source of chronic diseases. And what the philosophy tells us is that over the course of time, and indeed over the course of lifetimes, there are certain things within our nature. You know, so often we think, well, you know, spiritual and a spiritual being is always a nice being. Well, no. Sometimes spiritual beings do stupid things, and the, you know, thought of separation. Well, anyway, when the cause is deep within us, the ripple of effect actually ripples through our inner nature and has to find its way to balance, and we have to find our way inwardly to balance everything out, so that by the time finally it arrives in our physical nature and we're having this challenge and all this, well, we can, on the one hand, we can blame this, you know, how we're eating, and we can make adjustments to be as healthy as we can. However, there are plenty of ailments, we're told, that are the result of previous actions, and now that finally it's in the physical, it's finally being satisfied or ejected or harmonized or however you want to say that, you're done. We've learned the lesson, and we're ready to move on in a different way now. Yes, in the blue?
Well, aren't we attracted to those families where we'll have the best opportunity to grow, so that our family is a direct effect from causes we have set up in the past.
So the contribution here is we're born into a certain family, and so what's the karmic implication of that? That the tendencies in that family are in correspondence or harmonized with the prevailing primary affinities that we have as soul prior even to incarnating into the womb. Point being, though, interestingly, is fine, we'll incarnate into that family and take on, so to speak, the karma of that family and their culture and all the things that come without responsibility for the first portion of our lives, usually somewhere around 7 years. But the force of that karma may keep us, of course, in that culture all of our lives, but really the force of that karma may exhaust even within our childhood. It may just be the last end of a karmic experience. And come, you know, our teenage years, we have moved from a humble family with limited means, and we're born into this family, yet unexpectedly fantastic opportunities will open up to the child that the parents never had. And so there is the karmic affinity, which is in preparation for grander experiences yet. So not always are the children going to lead, obviously, exactly. You know, they're not condemned by karma. Things change. So on the one hand, there's the exhaustion of karmic force, which sets up opportunities in a new field of karma. But also, a change can be made by the power of a vow and the changing of one's mindset and making a determined effort in a particular direction that we decide. That's another way that we can not change. You don't change karma. You can't make karma go away, but we can counteract it by how we think and feel. We can mitigate the effects of karma. And in certain ways, it can be said, we can put this debt on a shelf for now, because I'm not going to operate in the field. Let's face it, if you don't have sex, you won't get an STD. So, in this lifetime, if you might have gotten one, but you never have sex, you don't have to worry about that. So move on. See what we're saying? Okay. So if you don't create the plane of action in which the karma can manifest, you have opportunities to grow in different ways. Now, it's going to come back eventually. But by then, you will have grown in wisdom, etc., etc., and you'll be more careful or more responsible and more able to handle what the potential effects of that are. Yes?
There's also another way to play with the notion of chronic disease.
Okay.
If we experience a particular chronic disease or a particular medical crisis, and we are testing out the notion of karma,
mm-hmm.
then we have a wonderful experience, a new playing field with which to gain wisdom so that as we recuperate, we are able to help someone else through that same process. And yes, it is the medical research now with the electric magnetism of the brain and all the chemical interactions of the physicality of the body and how thought and strong passion can influence all that. It's a marvelous time, kind of tongue-in-cheek, to have a chronic disease, to see what the medical research is,
right.
And also move through it in a more lighthearted fashion.
Thank you. And just to simplify that, we remember back, I think, in the early 70s, this concept of biorhythms. Do you remember that? And half the world was biorhythms. That's ridiculous. And now look what we've got. You know, I mean, everything's a biorhythm. That's a fact. Yes.
On a very personal level, the question of, okay, we're born into a family to experience that environment. Okay, you have a close-knit family. One of your siblings has repeatedly hurt you a lot. And so how do you deal with this? You work on forgiveness. Okay, I want to forgive her for doing these things to me. And a very wise person pointed out to me, what I need to do is forgive myself for having the resentments.
Ah.
And that was a real breakthrough.
So in certain ways, interesting, we're creating our own reality.
You can put your thought forms into this, I forgive her, I forgive you. I will not hold resentments, but I hold the resentments.
I see.
Now, if I can forgive myself for having the resentments,
then that's the cause we need to put into action to get the necessary effect. Thank you. So we'll, yes.
But getting back to illness, isn't it possible that some people become ill so that others don't have to?
Is it possible that some become ill so that others don't have to? Certainly, because there is so much to be learned. A friend of ours from high school passed about 2 weeks ago and had spent most of his last days with pancreatic cancer in Penn, in part of some research thing in Penn, and it was a sacrifice, literally, for him to do that. So we'll end with this. You know, karma is all part of the great law of periodicity, the coming and going, what goes around comes around. And out in the middle of the ocean, there were these two waves, a huge, big, fat wave, and in front of the fat wave was this little guy who was just keeping ahead of him, and the wind was blowing, and the sun was shining, and it was a great day to be a wave in the ocean. And before long, the big wave started getting sad. And the little wave looks up to him and says, you know, what's going on? What's your problem? This is a great day. And the big wave says, yeah, but you know, I can see a lot further than you, and you can't see that the shore is right in front of us, you know, another mile or so. And we're going to hit that shore, and we're going to be done. And the little wave says, don't you know, you're not a wave. You're the ocean. Our meeting's adjourned. Mm-hmm. Oh.